Okay, we're recording now, and this is an interview with Rosemary Luxton, L-U-X-T-O-N, at the Adelaide Zoo on the 10th of July 2006. And Rosemary has been a volunteer at the zoo for a long time and has lots of interesting stories and memories from coming here as a child. The interviewer is Catherine Murphy. So, Rosemary, tell me, first of all, your full name, maybe your maiden name, and your date of birth so I can get it recorded.
Rosemary Ann Wood, born in the 9th of the 3rd, 34, and my married name is Luxton, though I'm now divorced.
What's your first memory of coming here to Adelaide Zoo?
My first memory is probably the elephant, and the elephant was Lillian. And that probably would have been in about 1937 or 38. And I used to come on Sunday mornings with my father, who was an honorary member of the zoo. He was a professor of botany at the University of Adelaide. And most professors, I think, in those days had some sort of honorary position with the zoo, so they could come in on Sunday mornings when it wasn't open to the public. So my memories of going around with my father in this rather, I suppose, public-free, lots of space, lots of space to look at the animals, see the animals, not crowds of people. And my father knew a lot about animals, and because he was a botanist, he also knew a lot about plants. So we used to come and feed the elephant carob beans, and the elephant loved carob beans. And we'd usually do it, via the keeper. Bring in a bag, or in those days you could sort of come in with your brown paper bag full of these great long beans, and the keepers always knew that they loved these beans, and so they'd say, "Oh, would you like to give him one or to her one or two?" And so that was a great privilege.
Oh, how
and
gorgeous.
I came years later with my two children when we returned to Adelaide, and I remembered about the carob beans, and so I would go out with the children and collect carob beans before we came to the zoo. And in those days, it was Samoan, and Samoan would go around the elephant circle, and there were posts, and people would put peanuts and things on posts, or jelly beans, or all sorts of odd things, but we'd put our carob beans, our great long carob beans, and they were a great success. And all the other children used to get frightfully offended because she always picked up the carob beans and left the other things behind. So carob beans and elephants are some of my great memories of this zoo.
Wonderful story. So would they take the carob bean and crack the pod?
Just put it in hole.
Pick it in the hole. Mm. And where did you gather the carob beans?
Well, Adelaide's got a lot of them around. There's still one tree left in the zoo, actually. But there are a lot in the parklands. And when we came back to Adelaide, my mother's house was an old lodge, which was about 1850s, and that's about the time that the carob trees were planted. And so she had a whole great row of carob trees, which we used to pick and take in.
Oh, gorgeous. And I suppose the elephant must have been huge to a child of 4 or 5.
I was probably sort of about 3 or 4 when I first came. Lillian was one of the smaller elephants, but I think you're right that I wouldn't have known that. And, of course, I was brought up on the Bar books, and so elephants were a very important part of my childhood. My parents read to me, and the Bar books were one of the ones that they read. And so, elephants were a big part of my life. There's even pictures of me actually, feeding an elephant in Regent's Park in London when I was about 2 and a half. So, obviously, I was impressed with elephants from an early age.
Oh, they're very intelligent creatures, aren't they? And I suppose you had rides in the cart and...
Well, Lillian pulled a cart, but I don't remember that. I do remember my children having a ride with Simone in the cart. I just remember really feeding the elephant. Sunday mornings, the carts probably wouldn't have been operating, and that's largely when I came to the zoo. That would have been for public openings when the cart operated around the elephant.
And having such a special opportunity with your dad, who was knowledgeable. What other memories do you have about seeing the animals and learning a little bit about them at that time?
I remember the, I'm not even sure now if it's an alligator or a crocodile, but the one that we had for years and it was killed in the children's zoo in the disaster. But that, I remember that for years, and just sort of used to sit there. And it was down by the old elephant house in those days. I know it moved later, but in the time that I remember, it was down where there are now the emus in a small enclosure there, and it just used to lie there and never move.
Was that the white one?
Yes.
You said it was white.
It was white with age, apparently. It was very, very old. I'm not even sure how old it was. But I remember another animal down in that area, which is probably now where the sponsorship forms are opposite giraffe. But I remember going past and seeing a small bird aviary, the sort of thing about the size you might put a couple of budgerigars in now, and it had this tiny little animal in the corner. And of course, at that age, I always thought my father knew everything and he didn't know what this animal was. And that sort of surprised me tremendously. And we had to ask Mr. Haggard what it was, and it turned out to be a sugar glider.
So,
and it was just curled up in the corner and didn't act. In those days, they probably didn't bother much about vegetation. They probably didn't even know an awful lot about some of the Australian animals. And so it was just all curled up in the corner.
Maybe that was, there weren't many Australian animals in zoos then. They'd be more exotics.
Yes, my memory is of, you know, large animals, but then I think as a small child, that is what you remember. It's certainly nowadays what children ask for. They're the ones that they're impressed by, hippos and giraffes, things that are big, that they can see.
So when you say you asked Mr. Haggard, I know that you're referring to one of the directors of the zoo.
Yes.
And we're sitting now in Minchin House, what was the home of the Minchins. Did you come here as a child?
No, I didn't ever come here. I went to the koala farm, though, which was run by a Minchin, and that I remember that too as part of my childhood, but that must have been later because Mr. Haggard took over from the Minchin brother who died, and it was the other brother who ran the koala farm. So he must have lived and run that for a bit longer. It must have been during the war, I think, because I remember going there as in a train for a children's party to the koala farm.
So it was somewhere out of Adelaide?
No, the koala farm was on the other side of the bridge near the zoo, where the university playing fields are now. So the two were very close together.
Gee, that was a fantastic outing.
Yes, it was.
A train ride to the koala farm.
Yes.
And did you handle the koalas in those days?
Yes, you could handle koalas, and they also had what I thought were seals, but were possibly Californian sea lions. My memory is that they were smaller than the current sea lions we have in the Adelaide Zoo, but they used to perform there. So that probably means that the zoo did not have seals or sea lions at that stage because they were at the koala farm.
In enclosures with...
They used to do performances with balls and diving.
Wow. Did you find any photos when you were looking through the photos of that?
No, I can't. No, none at all.
Well, that's interesting. So would you be able to just give us a sketchy idea of your father's participation? I mean, I know that it won't be from the time when you were a child, but any knowledge that you would have from later years about your dad's participation as a member of the board of the zoo, I think, and what that meant and zoo ran in those days.
Well, I think he was an honorary member, so he probably wasn't actually on the board as such. I think, you know, rather as it is now, I would suspect that the university, and there's a lot of affiliations, direct and indirect, between the botany zoology departments for research and psychology and things like that. For research and students, so it was probably that sort of thing. But of course, Adelaide was smaller as well in those days. You're going back a very large number of years to the, 1939-40s, and also it was wartime. So I suppose people who were left behind and not actually serving in the war, sort of bonded together a bit more for discussion and interchange of information. But I was too young to really know how that worked.
Are there still animals in the zoo today that were here in those early days when you visited?
Yes, there is, the flamingo.
And that's all?
I think that's the only one that's, yes.
That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, that flamingo is actually a bit older than me.
Wonderful. So it sounds from what you said at the beginning that you had an intense connection with the zoo as a child, and maybe through your school years, I'm not sure, and then you broke and went somewhere else to live and then came back to Adelaide. Is that right?
Well, as I said, I've got another memory of the zoo in the earlier days, and that was of one of the monkeys, which I think was a baboon of some sort. And that was probably certainly during the war, because my father always used to go up to this animal and say, "Sarge, salute." And so, you know, and Sarge would salute. And again, it was probably symptomatic of those times that I remember him as an animal alone. And baboons, of course, are group animals, so that's something that has definitely changed over the years. Mm. So that's another of the earlier animal memories that I have. But yes, I suppose another memory that I have is not being able to go to the zoo. There was a polio outbreak in 1939, and I remember that being very upset at not being able to go, but the advice was, again, from someone like a scientific mind of my father, that, you know, you don't go anywhere where you get infections. And I also think that perhaps the zoo lost some animals at that time because, of course, polio was actually transmissible.
Across species.
Yes. But I'm not sure about that, whether that... But I had the feeling that I was told that some of the monkeys had died. And, you know, it wasn't a safe place to go. So for that period, of course, I didn't go. But my memory is that I went pretty frequently during the war years. Then I suppose I had younger sisters and maybe my father took them. I probably didn't go so often. And then I moved after university. University years, I was really too busy, which is interesting because I notice now that we get quite a lot of students that actually do pop into the zoo just for a an hour or so from the university. But my time there, I sort of didn't go to the zoo. And then I went overseas, and just about everywhere that I went, London, Whipsnade, one always went to the zoo. And then we came back to Sydney, and so the early years for my children were at Taronga. And so I did have a gap of about 20 years away from Adelaide too.
What was the impression when you came back to Adelaide and saw the zoo in the 60s? Had it changed much at all? Or had it maybe...
It was the 70s by the time 70s. I came back. Yes. Yes, it had changed. There were... It still had an awful lot of barred enclosures, but then most of the zoos I'd visited in Europe had too. And Taronga was not a good zoo for children. Taronga, I used to go with a lot of my friends, and because they knew that I loved zoos, and they would take me with them with their children. And my memory of Taronga is lifting children up constantly to show them things because they couldn't actually see them at their level. Mm. And I remember coming back here and finding with great relief that it was far, far easier to take children around the zoo. Not only was it all on the same level, but it was also much easier to see the animals. But a lot of the enclosures were bigger. I remember there was a very large monkey enclosure in the 70s where the baboons are now. And, of course, that was demolished later to make, even more open-range sort of enclosures. And, of course, I was a volunteer by the time they opened Southeast Asia One, which was the first of the really, really sort of new age developments at the zoo. Mm.
So maybe tell me about how you reconnected and became a member again and what era that was. Were you involved in some of the very early MAC committees?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't. I, as I said in the introduction, that I'm divorced, and that happened when I was 54, and I thought, well, I'd like another interest again in my life, and so I thought about the zoo again and I rejoined. And at that stage, they were doing zoo watches, and I was still working. I was a librarian, and I was working. But I was working for the government, and you could take flexi time. So when they had zoo watches, I would actually take a day off and come to the zoo and do watches on several of the primates, but also on the lyrebird. And it was during the time that the public service was actually being... reduced, and my particular area of it was being greatly reduced. So the lyrebird got a lot of my problems.
You told the lyrebird the truth.
Well, I just relaxed. It was rather terrible when you were having to carve up your department and decide how many librarians and how many library technicians and how many clericals you could retain and operate. So my day out with the lyrebird, I suppose, kept me sane.
Oh, wonderful. I can hear the samangs, is it, in the background starting to hoot a bit? So this is still in the 80s, though. It's a bit later, I think.
About 1989 I rejoined the zoo, yes. And Zoo Watch started about 1990-91. And I wasn't involved in the very beginning, which I think Mac Boyle may have told you about, because I think they did the very first watches on... mandrills and the lyrebird when it was in its other enclosure. I took up the lyrebird when it moved into its new enclosure where it is now.
And has the zoo, did the zoo watch become something that you had an ongoing connection with?
I was never on the committee, but I probably put in, there were two of us that probably put in more hours than anybody else in the first few years of its operation.
So tell me about... your interest in the observation of animal behaviour in that way and the recording of that detail. I mean, it probably isn't that romantic, you're out in the sun and the rain, but there's a certain level of connection there between human and animal too, isn't there, I imagine, to observe.
Well, I found the zoo watch very rewarding because it meant that you saw all sorts of behaviours which if you walked past an enclosure you would never ever see. And if you sit for 2 hours in front of an enclosure, you notice all sorts of things that you don't at other times, I found. And in those days, they gave us a lot of detailed background information on the animals, their names, their ages, all these sorts of things. So I found that I was sort of talking to the public, if it was a watch that allowed you to do that, about the information about the animals. And it was suggested to me in about 1992, I think, that I... by which time I had retired, that I should do the guide course because they heard me sort of imparting this information and they thought that, you know, it would be a good thing to become a guide. So I did the guide course in 1993 and I used a large amount of my zoo watch information really in my guiding and I found it invaluable. I guided very differently from a lot of the other guides because I knew their names, I knew their ages, and I did discover that the public actually really likes this. The idea that the animals have names intrigues the public, and it really is a very good talking point.
Mm. So what were your specialties from zoo watching into guiding? What were the animals that you carried that information from between zoo watch and guiding?
Well, I knew a lot about tree kangaroos. I'd done a lot of watching on tree kangaroos. I'd done a lot of watching on wombats. I'd done the lyrebird, of course. I'd done a very large number of primate watches. I was doing ones on orangutans and chimpanzees. And I had a great interest in primates. I'd also done a lot on the siamangs. They moved the siamangs from the wired enclosure to the Southeast Asia One, and I was involved in both the before and after watches there and got very, very involved with the siamang family and very, very intrigued by them because they're sort of a family unit, rather like humans, and, you know, very, very, very interesting to watch the dynamics there. I was heartbroken when the mother died and left the young baby who just didn't make it either because his mother died. You know, those of us who'd been involved in the watch, you understand how keepers get so involved with their animals, because if you've done watching, the same sort of thing happens. Mm. And I also was involved with the introduction of two groups of lion-tailed macaques, and I've always continued the interest in them as well as a group. They're now, of course, got a disease which is transmissible to humans, and so they've had to be, you know, kept a lot further apart, which they weren't in the beginning. But just watching the introduction of those two groups, there was a terrible fight, and you realise just how traumatic things like that were. I remember having to dramatically call the keeper and, you know, say, you know, help, help. And then they had to separate them and actually have them vet checked and things. Mm-hmm. But eventually the group got together, and you realise just what sort of power dynamics, you know, occur in groups of monkeys and apes. And another animal that I had a lot of involvement with was Biri, this male sea lion, who I watched from when he was first introduced into the sea lion pond. And I was there when he tried to climb out, and I had to actually call up the keeper and say, help, help, Biri is heading for the torrens. And Jason, who's still there, came back and, you know, got him down. And they did a lot of hot wiring. And Biri is still with us, a very large and enormous animal. He was then about 2 feet long, I suppose, and now he must be about 10 or 12 feet long.
Oh, my goodness. And this is all information you can't get out of books, because it's particular to an individual animal or a group of animals, isn't it? So yes. Whilst you might read about the generic behaviour of a group, of a species, you can't get that detail about that group in that enclosure.
No, and the story about Biri, I mean, I can still use, because he's still there. And I mean, I could say, well, you see that set of hot wires over there? Well, he, you know, they're there because he tried to climb out for the torrents when he was this long. And I mean, you know, people like stories like that.
Very good. And guiding remains your interest, your core interest, doesn't it, really?
Well, I am still guiding, but as I've got older, I only guide once a month now, and I do the information booth 2 days a month, because I find, you know, I just don't have the stamina that I had. But when I guide, I've also been involved in the group that did cage to conservation. I did the touch table area there, and I did actually say I wanted to be involved in the conservation part of it, because when I guide, that's what I like to concentrate on and tell people about our conservation projects. So I try very hard to keep up to date with what the scientific researchers are doing. I suppose it dates back to my father and the sort of background there, but I think they're important stories to tell, so I always like to try and find out what Greg Johnston, David Taggart and people are actually researching, what the current state of their information is. Because I love wombats, and David Taggart is actually doing research on the wombats, I always try and find out, you know, what the latest developments are there.
Can you tell us a little bit about what the zoo is involved with for conservation at the moment?
Well, they're doing research into the mange in the wombats now, but originally David Taggart was trying to work out whether they could use the southern hairy-nosed wombat in order to act as a surrogate for the northern hairy-nosed, which is highly endangered. And so they... but that is actually on hold now. I think because of the mange, apart from anything else, it's probably very hard to get animals that would be assuredly free of mange. He's also done research on the Gilbert's potoroo, and I was actually involved at one stage trying to acclimatise some of the long-nosed potoroos that they had in the vet centre. They were trying to acclimatise them to be used to humans, because they suffered stress very badly, but they discovered that when they reached maturity, they just go berserk anyway and don't like humans, so that didn't actually work out. But the previous vet was actually trying to de-stress the animals so that they were more handleable in order that this research could be undertaken to try and again breed up the Gilbert's potoroo, which is highly endangered in West Australia, using the long nose as surrogates. Mm. And much the same way that they're doing the surrogacy with the brush-tailed rock wallaby, with the yellow-footed rock wallaby. Mm. And that's, again, a story that I like to tell people about, though I've not been directly involved in any of the actual research.
Yeah, that's been very successful, I understand.
Yes, it has, except, of course, that they had this terrible setback with the first ones that they bred. They sent to Canberra, and they actually got wiped out in the Canberra bushfires. So it wasn't just the hazard of the Victorian bushfires that took the ones in the wild, but the ones that we had actually captive bred and that had been released in Canberra that got wiped out in their fires. Mm. So that was a double whammy. But I think they have retrieved the numbers now, and it has been a very successful project.
Mm. And I suppose there are other ways of thinking about the conservation issue too, isn't there? The way in which the children through the education centre are participating in the survival of some of the animals in other countries. The encouragement that's being given to local school children through the education, through AISES, to think about the survival of animals in the wild.
Well, I actually do food stores tours for the education group here, but we don't actually get much of a chance to talk about conservation programs. I think education does that. And largely, I think they've been heavily involved with the tigers and the bears.
Yeah, particularly the bears,
yes,
I think.
Yes, but you take the children behind the bears and talk about the bears, but largely as a dangerous animal, really, in that context, because you have to keep the children far enough away from the dens and all, poor distance away from being able to stretch out. And, of course, while we had Jacoby, the giraffe, we were able to actually feed the giraffe from behind and demonstrate to the children how the giraffe actually takes the leaves and wraps its long tongue around, which was very good. But I'm not sure with our current giraffes. I think that might be a long way down the track doing that again.
And the children are fascinated by the fact that you're actually breeding mice and rats to feed.
Out to the reptiles, yes. And... Well, it's always a bit of a shock to them. The butcher's shop's always a bit of a shock. You know, I usually hold up a small chicken and a large chicken and point out the lumps of meat. And when they know it's horse, they always, you know, a very large reaction. But you point out that, of course, in the wild, the lion would eat the zebra, and this is really the nearest thing that you can get to it. And I point out that there are in fact a large number of people who prefer that their old horses would come to the zoo, because the driver goes out there and actually shoots them in their home paddock, and they don't actually have to be transported disturbed, which can upset old animals anyway. But it's quite a hard sell, as are the rats and mice, because of course the they all look very cute, and there's always the babies, and the children tend to react badly, and particularly if you've got boys that have kept rats as pets, as my son did, you know, they don't like to think of them being fed out to the snakes. But I mean, it's just really, I mean, you just have to say to them, well, how else do you think we feed the animals and keep them alive? But it is something that people tend not to consider when they're thinking about the zoo.
So does that offer opportunities to suggest to the children that this is an arena in which wild animals aren't really wild, and then there are animals in the wild who are quite different in many ways to the animals that we keep in the zoo? Do we do some of that?
Well, it's a bit hard on a food store tour really to bring that in. That probably would come out more when you work on the touch table and things like that. one of the things that I've done when we've had special touch tables during school holidays on things like the lions and big cats is to, if you have a skull, say of a tiger, to point out the teeth and say, look, have a look at these. These are the killing teeth and these are the tearing teeth. And look how worn they are. Now, this was a zoo animal. In the wild, this animal would have died at 10 or 12, and this animal lived to be 20, 18, 20, 22, which is what can happen in a zoo situation as opposed to a wild situation. And point out that, in fact, animals do live far, far longer in zoos. In fact, we had a Siberian tiger here that they literally used to cut up its meat, and the children used to think that was a tremendous joke. And I said, well, not small pieces of meat like you'd do for your dog. But, I mean, a piece this size for a Siberian tiger is really quite a small piece of meat, and you don't expect the animal to tear it off the bone when it's got no teeth.
Mm.
So it's those sort of things where you can really bring home to children the difference between the wild and the zoo situation.
And you did could, you... Sorry.
I was just going to say, and you can also, of course, point out that, you know, that the ones in the zoo are really sort of carrying a banner for the wild animals. That's very good with the bilbies, for instance, in the nocturnal house. You can talk about the conservation programs and how these are, you know, are the captive bred ones and how they have actually gone back to the wild. Same with the yellowfoots. They've actually been put back mm-hmm. into the wild. And, you know, you can talk about the areas where you hope that might happen, like one day being able to send Sumatran tigers maybe back to the wild, or orangutans back to the wild. I mean, I believe that Perth Zoo is actually currently planning to send the first orangutan back to Indonesia. So, I mean, if that sort of thing happens, it's a wonderful flag.
Did you have any inkling of any of these behind-the-scenes issues when you were a young child coming here?
No, not at all. No.
It was completely
just front of house, even, yes, on Sunday mornings.
Yes. So how do you describe that change that's occurred between the 1930s and 2006?
Well, I suppose one of the things would be that perhaps they felt that behind the scenes was a bit cleaner and fitter to go to, though some of our areas still are not good. I was involved with the Southeast Asia One behind-the-scenes tours, which were special ones that we did at the weekends, where we called for interest and we charged some money, and that all went to the Rhinoceros Project in Sumatra. And that wasn't the new members behind the scenes tour. This was actually paid for by the public. But that was one of the first areas that was considered really clean and fit enough and, you know, able to safely show off what could happen. And what could happen with that, of course, was that the sun bears would come in, the keeper would allow them to come in, and people could actually see them at much closer range. But again, you had to make sure they kept back and point out the long claws and things like that. So that was probably the first area, and of course the new immersion will have offered far greater opportunities. But I have been involved in the new members tours since about, I suppose since I passed my guiding course. I've helped with those.
We might just have a pause and a drink of water while this... Oh, that was a shorter one. The one before went on for ages. So what does that contribute to the opportunities that are designed now to bridge the gap between humans and animals and educate people about what goes on to house animals in a zoo? What does that contribute, do you think, to our people, the general public, children who visit?
I'm not sure how well we convince the children if they are coming on new members' tours. I think it's different when they're in the school situation with the food store tours. Though there, even then it's quite hard to convince them about the food, because I usually do it on a Monday, which is their first day at the zoo, and they're very excited about the zoo, and they haven't seen very much of the front of house of the zoo. So taking them behind the scenes at that stage is usually a bit difficult, because they really want to know about the animals and the front of the animals and how they operate out front, rather than all about the food. And the food can be a bit hard to absorb. In new members' tours, we do food store as well, and I think it's the adults take that in much better again. A lot of our new members now are young families, and it's a very good time to become a zoo member, because, of course, it means that they can bring their children in for a short range of time, and they can stay for a couple of hours and then go home. But it does mean that the children in that age group are not really suited for behind-the-scenes tours, because it's a lot of information, and I think the parents get quite a bit out of it, and also sometimes photo opportunities. But for the children, it can be a bit boring, because we can't really gear it to both levels.
Yeah.
And so perhaps the children don't get as much out of it, but I think the parents do, because I think an understanding of how much it costs to run the zoo, how much the food bill is a week, the sort of people that are involved behind the scenes and how it all works, I think it is an eye-opener, particularly to members, because members in any case are going to be the rather dedicated people anyway. And so the new members' tours are really something that we give them as part of their membership. So it's not a fundraiser. It's something to give them an understanding of the zoo, and if they like to contribute in indirect ways. We tell them things like the sort of browse they could contribute, like if they want to cut down suitable trees or prune, anything that could be useful in that way. And sometimes you find people that have connections with butchers or some sort of elements of food that will say, we could contribute to the zoo. It doesn't happen a tremendous amount, but all those things probably do help. And it makes people realise, when we talk about beezer, the sort of things that people can contribute, like from pine cones and excess fruit and things like that. All those sort of things all help the operation of the zoo and make people realise, particularly with behavioural enrichment, that we're all trying very hard to keep the animals amused all the time.
And well and happy.
Well, the vets make sure that they're well and happy and healthy, but the behavioural enrichment is really up to the keepers, and what the keepers feel can be provided to give them that extra. And things like bears and primates do have to be kept very busy. In the wild, they spend most of their time looking for food. And, of course, in a zoo situation, if you just stick it in a bowl and give it, it's just, no answer. And one of the great things has been with the new immersion to watch what that's done for the orangutans. That wasn't a terrible enclosure they were in before, but what's happened since they've moved and they've got the ropes and they've got the transportable food up to the higher level has made such a huge difference to their behaviour and what people see that, you just can't help but be very, very pleased about it.
I hear they're acting up quite a lot.
Oh, yes, I think Carter. We've always said Carter is a one in a million orangutan.
Do you go up to Monarto at all? Are you connected in there?
I used to. I used to be a Wednesday volunteer, but I had breast cancer and found that carrying buckets of water, which was a lot of the Wednesday activities, I believe they're watering a bit more with hoses and things now, but in those days it was carrying buckets, and so that really got a bit beyond me.
Mm.
But I enjoyed that time because we were actually collecting seeds and, learning how... I don't think I'd ever realised that you needed hot water to germinate a very large number of eucalypts. So all that... I should have known, being a botanist's daughter, but I didn't.
Plant propagation. We didn't know anything about Australian plants in those days, did we?
No. It's like Monarto, actually, on the other side of the road, has got all those Western Australian plants. They're not even native to the area, which is what when we started doing the propagation we started to do.
It seems like a wonderful combination, Monarto and Adelaide Zoo, to have that opportunity for the free-ranging larger animals and then animals that are more contained right in the heart of Adelaide like this. That was a fantastic initiative. I mean, do you remember anything about those times? I think it was the 70s, 80s again, wasn't it?
I wasn't involved at any stage in the planning stage. I was involved before Monarto opened to the public. We were going out there, and they were having tours with buses that went through behind the scenes largely. And we were working up there then. One of the nice things about that those days were that it wasn't terribly organised, and because they were very short staffed, you actually went in and did things like going in with the giraffes and you know, helping to muck out the areas before they had the concrete slabs, you know, and getting really, really close to Katabi, who was a hand-raised giraffe and very tame, and, you know, so there were certain privileges that one had in those days, which are probably no longer possible.
Gorgeous. What do you think the central contribution is that the volunteers make to Adelaide Zoo?
Well, I guess it's our time and the fact that we are prepared to do such a wide range of activities. I think if you analyse the amount of time that some of the volunteers spend, it's really quite a lot. And I think that we do things, particularly in Zoo Watch, where the keepers are certainly probably better observers than we are because they know their animals better, but they just simply don't have the time, so that we can, at least under their instructions, provide them with sort of another pair of eyes. So to me, that's very, very important.
Mm.
I think with the guiding, there's a very large number of occasions when you're not really needed or wanted as a guide, but you can, as a static guide, perhaps take up a position in a particular place and help an animal. Like if there's been a birth or something, you can talk about the birth of the animal. Or if there's going to be a very crowded day, you can do something in front of the baboon enclosure and try and protect those poor animals from that persecution that they inevitably get from large volumes of the public. And even the lions, when they were moved to that new enclosure in the early days, we had problems, well, in both enclosures with school children. And so sometimes just being a static around that area can be useful for the protection of the animals.
Mm. And having seen many zoos in England and I think Europe as well, how does Adelaide compare, do you think, to those other places?
Well, I think it compares very well for its size. I really do. I think it's a very, very good zoo for small children. And I think that it's in a wonderful situation. There are not many zoos that are so close to the city centre and the big hotels. And I'm on a Monday morning usually guiding, and it's quite interesting that the people that you will get to guide are the people that will come through the gate at 9:30, the minute it opens, having walked from their city hotel. And, you know, you'll take round then. You won't wait for a 10:30 tour. You just say, would you like a tour, and off you go.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there are those advantages, and I think it would be a huge loss if we lost, mm-hmm. you know, the city location.
Mm-hmm.
I know that city locations have been a problem because, of course, London Zoo had exactly the same problem. It's one of the problems of ageing. And it's one of the problems of trying to replace areas. I mean, for instance, with the immersion, it's been wonderful. Now it's finished. But, I mean, it did cause problems while it was being built. And CO1 probably caused more problems because it was actually more centrally located in the zoo so that you had more disruptions with traffic and things going through and around. On the other hand, both developments have been wonderful behavioural enrichment for the great apes, who have always got on top of their poles and supervised everything.
I bet you could never have imagined what Adelaide Zoo would become when you're a little girl.
I couldn't. I mean, now there are no elephants, and I would totally agree with that. Having I've taken children in to see the space the elephant had. And I mean, that was tragic because, I mean, while they gave rides or while they pulled the carts around and had the activity, of course, they did get the exercise. But, I mean, elephants do need exercise. And once they were confined to the yard, poor Suborn really had a bad time. On the other hand, I don't think she should have been moved to Monarto because I think that animals do get used to where they are. And she was heartbroken because I was out at Monarto at that time. She was heartbroken at the loss of the public. She was used to the public, and she only really got her spirits back when the buses started to come around again.
What a show-off.
She just loved people.
Yeah.
So, you know, as these current giraffes from Monarto don't seem to like people and are only used to them in buses, so Suborn was just the opposite.
How gorgeous. So is there anything that I haven't asked you about?
I don't know whether you wanted to talk about the photographs we've finished.
I do want to talk about the photographs because you spent some years, didn't you, cataloguing?
About four years.
Yeah. So what would you say about that experience? And
well, it was fascinating. It really was fascinating. I worked with Margaret Nagel, and I'm very grateful for her good memory because, unfortunately, mine isn't very good anymore. And Margaret could remember things that we looked up and dates and things. But we did have a lot of reference books provided by the librarian, and we did have to constantly re-refer to them. But it gave us a very good insight of the early years of the zoo before we were actually operating, and also how many animals were lost, I suppose, because we had to look up records and things for dates of birth and try to estimate when a photograph had been taken and who it was. And we had to get histories from some of the keepers who were still around who remembered them. And, you know, you would look up the animal records and realise that really a huge number of animals were lost in the earlier years, which wouldn't be the case now. There were only honorary vets and things like that in the 30s when I would have started. Whereas now, and I mean, think Dr. Schultz only came in the... He's been here 20 years, so he must have come in the 80s. And that's the first full-time vet. And before that, they were honorary positions and people, usually a vet on the council, I believe. Or else a vet who was actually also a curator or something like that.
And did you get an overview of how things changed in the way in which animals were represented or species were represented, the way in which it was possible to import animals from one country to another, any of...
Well, yes, you got an inkling of the fact that for a long time the zoo paid for animals. They were either given, donated. In the very early days, there were benefactors who not only gave buildings like the Rotunda and things like that, but they also gave animals or paid for animals. But then animals like elephants then had to be bought. And then they're giving rides or pulling carts. The early elephants, of course, gave rides, but they had to cover their costs virtually, and this was what was expected of a zoo. One of the things that we did, we had to, towards the end, for the librarian wanted to put all the photos on disc, and this didn't actually turn out for the elephants. We did it initially for the elephants in the hope that that would save the actual original photos from too much use, but it turned out that this new technology is not quite up to the mark, and the graphics artist had to actually go back to the originals for the Elephant House graphics. So, but what it made us do was to put together our cataloguing, which had only been in photos that hadn't been catalogued before. We had to amalgamate them with the ones that had been previously catalogued. And we did that for the buildings, and that was particularly interesting because that gave us an overview of, you know, how the enclosures had changed over the years. And so, you know, looking at the old maps and where things originally were was fascinating. And we would get some of the older keepers to come in and take us through the maps and say what was in which enclosure in their day. And we actually did take an oral history from one of the keepers.
Who was that from? Was it Werner or?
No, Werner hasn't been done. I think that's to be done. Here. It's to be done. This was. Wasn't it terrible? I'm sorry. The name's
The New Zealand man.
Yes.
I can't remember what his name is either, but he's been mentioned to me.
Yes. Yeah. Well, the librarian will be able to give you the details. I'm terribly sorry about that. But we drafted out a list of questions and then, you know, conducted an interview with him. And
I'd love to hear that. Be very interesting.
Well, it would certainly.
Rosemary would have it. Is it
Sylvia? Sylvia would have it. Yes. Sylvia would have it. She's got that, yes.
Anything else about the photos? I mean.
Well, the other ones we amalgamated were the primates, and that again was very interesting. And we also had to select some for the banners and some for a calendar. And that was a very interesting. It was 125 years of the societies. I think it was 120 years of the zoo and 125 years of the society. And there was a calendar and the banners, and some of the banners are still up and some of them aren't. We made some mistakes with the banners because we used tiny photographs, which we couldn't really see what they were, and we took it on other people's memories of what they were, and that turned out to be wrong. So that was an object lesson in life. And the calendar, we chose things that we thought were symptomatic of the old zoo, and then they were overridden with sort of photographs of the coloured photographs of the current animals. And that turned out to be a total failure as a sales item. The keepers hated it, absolutely hated it, and refused to buy it. They said it, and I suppose it shows how far zoo keeping has moved, that they really resented the photos that this represented. So if you haven't seen the calendar, you must ask.
They resented.
They just felt it was the wrong image that we had.
Oh, they wanted to choose the image.
I think they wanted really
like baby photos.
A greater preponderance of current things, and to see all the bars and the sort of things, and the dressed up chimpanzees and things like that, which is what they did, chimpanzee tea parties. And, you know, and there was one chimpanzee that used to smoke. So, I mean, we didn't have that in the calendar, but we knew it happened. I mean, all these things are zoos past.
Yeah, it's like talking about the past, isn't it? Yeah. The Germans talking about their past, or the zoo talking about, you know, it's something that needs to be done to acknowledge where you've been and where you're going.
Yes, but it was interesting that not one keeper would buy it.
Oh.
They just, so that was really a, you know, rather sad, because we put a lot of energy into choosing what we thought were, you know, fairly representative old photos of various aspects of the zoo.
And, so you did buildings, and getting the history. Primates.
Yes, primates again was interesting thing. Because there was a lot of hand rearing of primates in the early days. They, in fact, when I first started Zoo Watch, the one on the Siamangs was fascinating. They thought that she wasn't feeding it. And it was only by doing the zoo watch that it proved that she actually was. But the Siamang baby actually hangs very low. It doesn't hang high up. It hangs virtually from its mother's hips, because the mother is sort of swinging through the trees and this leaves her arms free to actually move.
And we just pause while this... Oh, sorry. I'm so aware of the background noise. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
That's all right.
But you found that she actually
We found,
was
as a result of our zoo watch, feeding. That she was actually doing adequate feeding, and up till then they had taken all the Siamang young away and hand-reared them.
Oh.
And, of course, this was standard practice with orangutans. I mean, Carter was only partly mother-reared, and it's one of the troubles with her, really, that she, you know, she's never actually seen, she hasn't been reared as an orangutan, really. And so she's a bad mother. And that's San Diego, that's not here.
Yeah, so how many animals currently in the zoo would have been raised by their mothers or even...
Well, all of them. All of them are. All of them have
been...
They are now. Yes. They've all been raised by their mothers. But it's been a cost to the baboons, because if you read the history poster that's up on the Baboon kitchen wall, we do have a father who kills his young. Mm. And so that's been a problem, but they did insist that they didn't want to have to hand rear baboons, that they, and so they've persevered and they've actually got three, we hope, through to, might get through to adulthood.
Wonderful. We were talking to Sue Huddy this morning.
Well, she probably told you all about that.
She told us a little bit about the infanticide of the babies.
And they've got a langur, you see, that langurs are group monkeys, like baboons, and we've only got three, and we've got the problem that none of the females have actually seen a baby reared. And so the last, we've got a pregnant langur now, and she may not be able to rear her second one, though there's always a problem that the first one, even in the wild, quite often a primate will lose its first baby.
Mm.
But I don't know what they'll do with the langur. Our zoo is not alone in this. I went to Perth for a primate conference earlier in the year, and they've got a family of gibbons who have much the same problems, but they've found that they've partly raised the young one, but next to its mother, close enough that they were able to reintroduce it, but they had to give it extra milk and extra feeds. And so they may do that with this langur, if you've got a mother that doesn't know how to feed it and doesn't want it.
It just makes me feel how close we are to animals, humans. You know, how there's so very little difference, really, behaviourally.
And how important it is that they see something happen. They have to be
same
able to
learn
by seeing it.
Yeah. To experience something is to learn.
And particularly with primates, which I'm sure Sue would have conveyed to you.
Mm. I'm sure you've got lots of other little stories that are fascinating in there. The chimpanzee tea party, which just slipped out.
Well, that was from the photographs. I didn't go to the...
Any other little stories like that from the photos?
Oh, well, we used to have the koala, the bushfire koala, but I think that moved up to Cleland once Cleland opened.
Mm-hmm.
That used to be centred here.
Mm-hmm.
The elephant used to have a birthday party.
Gorgeous. With cake?
Yes, with cake. Edible cake, suitable for an elephant, but, you know, with food in it, suitable for an elephant. But, yes, there were lots of things like that in those days. And as I said, these two chimpanzees were hand-reared by one of the keeper's wives, and she used to push him around in a pusher. And I think there was sponsorship on the pusher. But, I mean, you know, these photographs exist. They're fascinating.
I love the one of the lion cub on the leash
that's
the
beautiful.
Director. That's stunning.
That's not the director.
Oh, who is it? Is it a keeper?
That's a keeper. He actually raised that lioness, and that... She's actually a wonder story because she actually, though she was hand-reared, she actually reared her own and lived to be about 18 and had a very large number of cubs. So she was a success story. But Lancaster, yes, the director, Lanky, he actually did hand-rear a very large number of cats. He was mad on lions. And Caesar was his favourite. And there are some absolutely wonderful photos of Lanky face-to-face with Caesar. And this wonderful story, which did Mac Boyle tell you the story? It was actually her husband's story.
Oh, the giraffe story?
No, the story of the lion.
No?
No, there's a story about how Lanky was worried because the lion, Caesar, had just gone back to the enclosure, decided he was too big and that he really needed to... get out of the house and into something a bit more stable. But it was a very cold, wet night, and Lanky was worried about him, so he went to check on him, and apparently he fell over. And in the morning, the keeper came in to find the lion sitting on top of Lanky's chest in the yard. And, you know, horror, horror, what am I going to find? And the lion was just keeping him warm.
Oh, how gorgeous. Listen, we've only got a few seconds left on this tape, so I am going to say thank you very, very, very much for that interview. It was the most fascinating interview, Rosemary, and Glynis, who was sitting in here too.
Thank you. It was good.
Thanks heaps.